This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
And so I think over time, what we'll see is a whole bunch of technologies come to maturation. We can ferment wood sugars. We've already done it. We can convert those into jet fuel. We can convert the sucrose from cane. We can do beet sugars, cassava. Pretty much anything that can be fermented into a beer, we can make into a jet fuel from carbohydrates. And that's what makes it interesting for the airlines industry, because you're not limited to one particular geography, one particular type of a feedstock, one particular type of a business system.
Is the biofuel craze of a few years ago really dead? This week's guest on Sea Change Radio, Pat Gruber, thinks not. While plummeting oil prices may have flattened the appeal of biofuel in the auto industry, the air travel industry's interest appears to be just taking off. Gruber's company, Gevo, provided the fuel for the first corn-powered commercial passenger flight in U.S. history this month. We discuss his company's technology, the competitive biojet fuel landscape, and what feedstocks are likely to be used to power future flights. Then we dig into the Sea Change Radio archives to hear from longtime airline industry analyst Bob McAdoo. He breaks down airline pricing models that often leave travelers flummoxed. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Patrick Gruber. He's the CEO of Gevo. Pat, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it.
So first, for our listeners, why don't you give us an overview of Gevo? What do you guys do?
Sure. So Gevo is a new technology company. We're commercializing a set of technologies around how do you convert renewable resource-based raw materials like carbohydrates into true drop-in products that can displace the fossil-based products. We do a fermentation to produce a chemical called isobutanol. We've done a genetic modification to yeast, like brewing yeast, and we have changed those yeast so they quit producing ethanol and produce our chemical isobutanol instead. And isobutanol is a chemical that a lot of people are familiar with because it's one of the flavor odor characteristics of a Scotch whiskey, say, compared to a bourbon. What we've done is shut off these yeast's ability to make ethanol and instead shift all the carbon into isobutanol. Isobutanol is interesting because it has markets as a product sold to the solvents industry, so we do that, and it just displaces the fossil-based isobutanol. Because we make it inexpensively, we can convert it onward to make other products. So, for instance, we do chemistry on that isobutanol. We have a chemical plant down in Texas where we convert that isobutanol into a product called octane, which everybody has heard of because it's the good stuff of gasoline. And then we also convert it into jet fuel, which is what Alaska just flew on the other day. And then we also sell isobutanol as a specialty gasoline blend stock, and it's particularly relevant for people who are interested in boats or operate boats, because isobutanol solves a lot of the problems that people associate with biofuels. In other words, our isobutanol, when it's blended in gasoline, puts renewable content in, but it's not water-soluble at all. It has high energy and high octane, so it's possible to have an ethanol-free, high-octane, renewable resource-based content gasoline using isobutanol as a gasoline blend stock. So we focus on that market as well.
And we've been covering biofuels in different forms here on Sea Change Radio for several years. And one of the things that has been promised by the industry for years is that someday we'll be able to use these fuels in airplanes. And as you mentioned before, this recently just happened on an Alaska airline flight. Why don't you give us the backstory behind this historic flight?
Yeah, it actually goes back quite a bit of time. I've spent my whole life doing renewable resource-based chemicals, plastics, and fuels, my adult career anyway, and have worked on this. And we've done lots of products over the years. One of the things that I always wanted to do was jet fuels. And this is kind of on a crusade of how do we get rid of fossil-based greenhouse gas emissions and the pollution that goes with them, all the trace chemicals, particulates, and stuff like that. You have to have a technology that can be cost competitive in the long run. That's fundamental. So how does one do that? Well, you need an extremely efficient technology to convert things that are grown into these classic hydrocarbon products. We have to have the products themselves be exactly the same as what's used normally, because we can't have everybody changing all planes, all engines to accommodate something we might make. Instead, we have to make our technology make exactly a jet fuel. So 9 years ago, I came to Gevo, and that was what was on my mind. And my first presentations for raising money were all about that, that we're going to develop a technology that ultimately gets into jet fuel via isobutanol. And then we started working on it, developed the technology. It took us 6 years to get the jet fuel approved through the ASTM process. The ASTM is the international testing body that certifies or does the specification for what can be flown on with a with commercial airlines using a jet fuel. It took us 6 years to get the approvals all completed. And that was just 2 months ago. And now we find ourselves being able to fly commercially. So for me, it's kind of a big deal because, you know, 9 years ago, this is what we intended to do. We're only partway there. We have done this flight. That's great. It's a milestone. And we have, you know, we produced that jet fuel at a demo plant, a small plant down in Texas. I need to build a really big commercial one and have lots of customers to buy the product. That's what's next.
And describe the partnership with Alaska Airlines that allowed this flight to happen.
So the issue that the airlines industry faces is that they know that they are a major contributor to greenhouse gases and pollution that goes with it. They know that. They also know that they cross lots of geographies, and it's in the airlines industry's interest to make sure that they are proactive in dealing with greenhouse gases and the pollution, because they don't want to have to face separate laws all across the world in every single region. That's a problem for them. It'd be tough to comply. So instead, the airline industry is interested in and has said that they'll regulate themselves. Well, for them to do the mitigation of greenhouse gases, you only can do so much through efficiencies of airframes, efficiencies of engines. You got to have biofuels, and you got to have low carbon biofuels. And so Alaska is a company with good vision. They recognize that this is in their long-term strategic interest. And so we did a partnership with them to help move this along. And it's important because, you know, it's one thing to get ASTM certified. It's another thing to put it in a plane and actually fly on it. It was fun for me to be able to fly on that plane. But, you know, all the customers on that plane appreciated it. They clapped. They were happy to have a biofuel on board.
Maybe you can give us an apples-to-apples comparison in terms of the emissions. I know if we went through the supply chain, it probably wouldn't be a fair comparison yet, because Gevo hasn't reached the kind of scale that an ExxonMobil has, obviously. So your economies of scale, your processes will reflect that. So in a pure emissions comparison, maybe you could give us an idea of how this flight on Alaska Airlines compared to a standard Alaska Airlines flight in terms of emissions.
Well, I can give you a sense of it. So one of the fundamental differences between a jet fuel made from renewable resources and one from oil is that 100% of the carbon content of our jet fuel is renewable. And then it's a question of how much energy did we use in producing that. In other words, I have coal-fired electricity in my plant in Minnesota, and we have to use natural gas to heat up to make steam. So I have to take those into account when I'm counting greenhouse gases to be complete. But the farmers also grow the corn, and what's interesting there, when they grow the corn, they're building up soil carbon, so there's actually a sequestration that occurs because they do low-till farming practices to protect the land. So when you add all that up and take it into consideration, if you use the EPA numbers, the greenhouse gas emissions from a kerosene made from renewables like we've done is about 50% or more than those made from oil. The Alaska flights that they did were 20%. The content of biofuel was 20% in the overall mixture. So I didn't do the math to calculate exactly, but it matters, you know, in terms of the greenhouse gas reduction.
So you really have to kind of look under the hood and delve into the entire process, to be fair.
That's true. You have to look at the right way to count greenhouse gases. If you have to do cradle to cradle or sometimes people call it cradle to grave. So how the stuff is grown through the whole life cycle, through the whole supply chain, delivered to and then flown, and once it's burned as a fuel, you have to consider all of that, and is the proper way to do it. And it's really the only way to do it. To fall within the specification of a jet fuel, it has to burn the same. Now, it turns out that ours burns with a little bit more energy than a petrol-based jet fuel, but it's still within the specification. The other things that you get with a jet fuel like ours is that we have very, very, very low particulate matter. That's important for pollution. And the other thing is that we have very low sulfur content, and that's important for mitigating pollution as well. So not only do you get a reduction in greenhouse gases, you get a reduction in these other things, while maintaining all that high energy that you need to be, you know, a real live jet fuel.
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come fly with me, let's fly away. Come fly with me, let's float down to Peru. In Llama Land, there's a one-man band, and he'll toot his flute for you. Come fly with me, let's take off in the blue.
Once I get you. Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Patrick Gruber. He's the CEO of Gevo. So, Pat, maybe you can give us your vision of the biojet fuel industry 4 or 5 years from now. How standard will it become for passengers to be flying on biojet-fueled planes?
Well, I hope to make it pretty darn common, because thinking to the future, it takes us 2 years to build a big commercial plant. So we're working right now on lining up the supply chain, lining up the customers, to be able to justify building of those plants. So we do that. We have to do one big plant first. So that call that, it takes 2 years, 2.5 to 3 years. Along the way, we'll have secured other customers. So call that maybe we add 2 or 3 more plants in. So in a 5-year period, there could be quite a lot of gallons of jet fuel around. It's still, by the standards of the, or the size of the jet fuel industry, it's very, very small, but it could be up in the, it could be in the multi, you know, 100 million gallons or more. And what that means is that we'd be focused on a couple, 3 airports. That's about how much volume that would be. And so this might be SeaTac, who is, you know, wants to be a leader in bio-based fuels and sustainable products. Perfect. And then there's other ones around the country who have a similar type of a vision. So that's where we would start, and it would grow from there. So what you would expect to see is relatively low blend levels.
And you've already made inroads with the U.S. military as well, correct?
In fact, the military is very interesting. We have flown. They've used lots of our product and tested it on all their major airframes, except I think the F-35 they still have to do. But other than that, everything's been tested and checked out. And so we'll bid on those contracts as well, and that'll be interesting for us.
So beyond Gevo, do you see Big Oil becoming your competitors? Give us a snapshot of the competitive landscape, if you will.
Sure. When it comes to the jet fuels, or renewable resource-based or low-carbon jet fuels, there's only a few choices that are available. One of them is ours. One of them is a company called Amyris has a technology where they do use sugarcane as a feedstock, or the sugar from sugarcane as a feedstock, into a technology to make a chemical called farnesane, and then they put that into jet fuel. And then there's one called HEFA, and I don't even remember what HEFA stands for, but the technology is to take like a vegetable oil or tallow or something like that, and then do a chemical process to it to convert it into a usable form of a jet fuel. I think that overall we would win on economics across the board. And ours is a standard kerosene product like you'd find in a jet fuel, and it does have some nice properties too. And so I think that we're in an outstanding competitive position. Now, there's many other people around the world who are trying to develop new technologies, but they have to get through the ASTM process. And as I said, that took us 6 years, and it was a lot of work. So we're in a good competitive position.
One of the things we hear a lot about when we're looking at the oil industry and the energy industry on the whole is price points where it becomes viable. For example, the Alberta tar sands apparently were not very viable in a $30, $40 a barrel environment. But when oil started getting into the $80 to $120 range, all of a sudden people started really trying to figure out ways to extract that in a much more aggressive fashion. How do you see the price of oil affecting the biojet fuel industry?
So I think when it's $30 oil is ridiculously cheap. That's a below production cost, so it'll go up. And so the question is, what will it go up to and in what time frame? Most people that I meet think that it should be the natural price, given the supply and demand across the world, should be somewhere in the $70 to $80 range. In that range, if I had a full-scale plant operating, I think I could be competitive, given the current biofuels policy in the United States, meaning there's RINs. RINs are the renewable, the policy that requires the oil industry to adopt biofuels. And so they're accountable for having the oil industry is accountable for having a certain percentage of, or certain number of gallons of renewable content in putting it into the market. And so I think probably in that $70 to $80 range in the current biofuels policy, we'd start to become competitive. If there was no biofuels policy, then no benefit or credit or something from having a renewable resource-based fuel and low carbon, it might be up a little bit higher. But when I say competitive, I mean competitive or cheaper is what I mean compared to oil-based jet fuel. And so we think of it in a very practical sense is that people who work with us in the long run would be expected to make more money for the airline by using a renewable resource-based fuel. That's what we would expect over the long run.
Even people who follow the industry probably get confused when it comes to figuring out which companies make what fuel out of what feedstock.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very fragmented market still. On one hand, that sounds like a downside, but looking at it through a glass half full lens, it actually could allow for the industry to flourish without being so resource intensive. Well, we're not just growing corn for fuel, for example. How do you see the heterogeneous nature of feedstocks influencing the long-term viability of biojet fuel?
I have a real simple point of view in that the source of renewable carbon is carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And so that carbon dioxide gets put into plants via photosynthesis. And everybody learned that back in grade school. And so when it goes through photosynthesis, it makes a carbohydrate first, no matter what the product is. So the question is, from that initial carbohydrate, what happens next? Some technologies where the carbohydrate gets converted to vegetable oil, and we talked about those. That would be a HEFA-type process where the vegetable oil is captured and then converted into a jet fuel. Other processes could take that carbohydrate. It might go into starch, or it might go into cellulose, or one of these other kind of plant products. It's still a carbohydrate. And so the question is, what carbohydrate where? How much does it cost? Where is it located? And what form is it in? And it's kind of, that's the problem, or the opportunity. Because in different parts of the world, you have different sources of carbohydrate. The practical cheap thing here in the United States is corn. And what's interesting here is that corn growing practices have changed and how we process products have changed. So for instance, in an acre of corn, we would generate 300 gallons of jet fuel in 2 tons of high-protein animal feed, and the farming practices have improved so much that the soil carbon builds along the way, so it's actually sequestering carbon. In South America, it's all about sugarcane. That's what they use, and that technology doesn't generate anything for the food chain at all, but it's an efficient way of generating sugar, so that's what people would want to use in, say, Brazil. In other parts of the world, it might be a cellulosic feedstock because in Southeast Asia, you can grow woody products very, very fast. Same thing true up in the Pacific Northwest. And so I think over time, what we'll see is a whole bunch of technologies come to maturation, which allow us to extract wood sugars. We can ferment wood sugars. We've already done it. We can convert those into jet fuel. We can convert the sucrose from cane. We can do beet sugars, cassava, pretty much anything that can be fermented into a beer. we can make into a jet fuel from carbohydrates. And that's what makes it interesting for the airlines industry, because you're not limited to one particular geography, one particular type of a feedstock, one particular type of a business system. Yes, the technology to convert those carbohydrates into a jet fuel is the same, but it can be done all over the world at a big scale.
He's the CEO of Gevo, Patrick Gruber. Pat, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much for having me.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Presidio Graduate School in San Francisco, offering MBA and MPA degrees in sustainable management. Learn more at presidio.edu.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
My guest on Sea Change Radio is Bob McAdoo. He's a senior airlines analyst at Avondale Partners. It's an institutional brokerage. He's worked in the airline industry for over 35 years. Bob, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Good to be here.
Bob, can you talk about how you see airlines dealing with rising fuel costs down the road in the decades ahead?
Well, there's really two or three things that have happened, have happened and continue to happen. I think there has been it's constant pressure on the manufacturers to come up with ways to make airplanes more efficient. And more efficient, you know, in some respects, I guess you could say getting a bigger airplane is more efficient because you still only have two pilots. Maybe that's one kind of efficient. But one of the other things is, if you see airplanes flying, you see an airplane sitting in an airport, and out at the end of the wing, they've got these pieces of metal that flip up that maybe go 2, 3, 4, 6, 8 feet tall out on the end of the wing, depending on the type of airplane. I mean, those are the kinds of things that have come around which reduce the burn, fuel burn, up to 4 or 5%, believe it or not. Having extra weight, extra length on that wing and having it tip up at the end, and don't ask me to explain how because I'm not an engineer, but that actually causes it to go through the air smoother, easier, and saves fuel. So you see those kind of things. The other thing you see is, take a company like Continental Airlines, which has focused on keeping a very modern fleet and continue to upgrade their fleet probably more rapidly than others. You know, as I recall, the amount of fuel that they burn now for each mile that they pull a seat through the sky is down something like 20% versus what it was a few years ago. You know, so there's still people who have some things to do in terms of getting up to speed that way, in terms of current technology, just like, you know, a 1974 Pinto is a very small car, but it only got about 18 miles to gallon, where that same size car today, with today's technology, would be a 35 or 40 mile per gallon car. The same thing goes. You have a 100-passenger airplane that's 30 years old versus a new 120-passenger airplane. You're going to burn 15-20% less fuel just because of different, you know, more modern engines and what they've learned about how to shape the wings and whatever. So that is one thing. You know, the other thing is, how do you, you know, so there will continue to be those kind of pressures, and there is a new generation of engines that Pratt & Whitney, part of UTX Corporation, is coming out with, that in another 2 or 3 years is again supposed to take another 15-20%, as I understand it, off of fuel burn. So there are those things. They are expensive. Not everybody can afford to do them. The other thing that happens is that, you know, as the price of fuel goes up and you have to try to, you know, not spend all your money on fuel, you know, you say, gee, the price of something, my costs go up, therefore I need to raise the price. Well, you can't just raise the price of all the tickets 20-25% to cover the cost of fuel that's doubled, if that's what it were, if that's what were to happen. So what has happened is that the airlines have figured out that one of the ways to deal with this is to actually reduce the number of seats, they offer, you know, like instead of having four flights a day, 7 days a week, maybe it's four flights a day, 5 days a week, and a couple of days a week they don't operate. So they squeeze down the number of seats, the number of departures, and therefore the number of seats that they're offering in a market. When you do that, one of the things that is clear, I think we've all noticed, is there's some people, sometimes you get a $400 ticket, some people pay $300, some $200, all in the same flight, and maybe there'll be some people at $99 and some people at $49. You know, and with that, what happens is if you squeeze down the amount of service you have in a market, what happens is you, in effect, have to squeeze off, you know, the guy who is the $49 guy maybe doesn't get a seat because we just don't have enough seats left for him. We're gonna save the seats for the higher priced guy. That gives you the ability to raise the average ticket by not having any $49 guys on the flight anymore. It raises the average ticket without having the other 90% of the people have to pay more.
One thing that I also read about was that the cost of these high end tickets, the first class and the executive class tickets, the carbon footprint of those are significant because they take away seats on the plane.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, when you think about it on an airplane, I mean, the thing about the basic economics of the business is that, you know, you're in effect renting space. It's no different than, you know, renting a one bedroom versus a four bedroom apartment, you know, in a building. You know, you're renting more space when you have the fancier ticket, you know, the bigger ticket. And so, you know, in effect, you could, although I've never heard anybody actually do it this way, you could, in fact, just sitting here thinking out loud, you could do a calculation that was, you know, pounds of fuel burned per square foot or per square inch or whatever on the plane. And you know, with that, sure enough, you would clearly burn more fuel for the big seat with lots of leg room and the ability to lay out flat and all that, simply because you are consuming many more square feet than those who sit in the back and have our neighbor's elbows and our ribs.
Bob McAdoo, Senior Airlines Analyst with Avondale Partners in Kansas City. Bob, thanks so much for being my guest on SeaChange Radio.
It's been enjoyable. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Bluesiana Triangle, Frank Sinatra, and Silver Convention. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.